We have a really, really fantastic guest this evening. His name is Dr. Nader Hashemi. He received his PhD from the University of Toronto and his MA from the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University. He was a research affiliate at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard, an Andrew W. Mellon postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Political Science at Northwestern, and a global fellow at the UCLA International Institute. Currently, he's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver's Joseph Korbel School of International Studies. Dr. Hashemi has contributed to the New York Times, Time, the Wall Street Journal, CNN, and has appeared on the PBS NewsHour. He's also the author of Islam's Secularism and Liberal Democracy and the co-editor of The Syria Dilemma and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. Please welcome Dr. Hashemi.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm a big fan of public radio. I was born and raised most of my life in Canada, where we also have a public radio system called the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, whose aim is to contribute to the public good. And so any organization or radio station that's contributing to the public good, I'm happy to play my role and make a contribution. Now, the topic that's been announced is one that you're all familiar with. It's the current turmoil in the Middle East, the rise of ISIS. How can we explain what's happening in this world? It seems very bewildering. It seems very confusing. What's the best analytical framework or point of departure to understand ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria? Is the problem with ISIS fundamentally a reflection of something within the Islamic faith or Arab culture, as many people believe, not just members of the reading public, but sophisticated policy wonks and intellectuals like Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, who has argued that the problem with the Middle East is that this is a part of the world that has not come to terms with modernity? Is that what's going on? Or is President Obama correct? On several occasions, he's used the phrase ancient sectarian differences. And in his recent State of the Union address, he's tried to explain the turmoil in the Middle East dating back millennia, he said, suggesting that perhaps what's happening in the Middle East today is something akin to the Christian wars of religion in the 16th and 17th century, implying that there's not much anyone can do. We simply have to wait until these conflicts burn themselves out. Or conversely, is the problem with ISIS and the broader turmoil in the Middle East to be located in a more recent historic moment, the 2003 American invasion and occupation of Iraq, that destroyed that society and created a lot of chaos? So what's the best entry point? I think all of those three scenarios have an element of truth within them. But in terms of my own understanding of this part of the world, I've spent most of my life studying this part of the world, teaching this part of the world, writing about this part of the world, traveling to this part of the world. I think structurally speaking, the roots of the ISIS crisis can be located and it should be located at the intersection of two sets of political developments that have been brewing in the region for several decades. These developments have been quietly corroding and corrupting the societies and politics of the Middle East, and they have now converged at this moment in time to produce a set of social conditions conducive to the birth of radical Islamist extremism. The first development, which has a longer history, is a direct byproduct of the legacy of political authoritarianism in the Middle East. The second development, which is more recent, is the predictable destabilizing consequences that flow from war and state breakdown. Let me just say a bit more about those two themes. For much of the modern history of the Middle East or the Arab Islamic world, most of these societies, most of these states have been characterized by various forms of non-democratic regimes, authoritarian regimes, family dictatorships, clans, who have ruled their societies in a very repressive manner. Now, the authoritarian regimes that exist in this part of the world vary. They're not all exactly the same. But what they do have in common is that they are non-democratic. They do not tolerate open public contestation and criticism of ruling elites. And if you do that, if you do speak out publicly, if you do cross the red line that these ruling elites have drawn, the consequences are quite severe. This has been going on decade after decade. And this has consequences. Generation after generation of people have been raised in authoritarian regimes, some of them very brutal, very despotic, very tyrannical. Societies that are ruled in that manner for long periods of time end up producing chaos, misery, and mayhem. And that this is a big part of the background to the ISIS crisis. The other development is the theme of war, state breakdown, and state collapse. I'll say something about that in a moment, but let me just drive home the point of how the legacy of political authoritarianism or political tyranny has produced consequences that now I think cannot be ignored in terms of an objective understanding of this topic. And I think the concept of social cohesion here is relevant. Social scientists have long recognized that stable political systems are rooted in a dense network of voluntary citizen associations that help sustain civil society and produce harmonious communal relations. This generates what's called social capital and social trust, and it produces cooperation between citizens of diverse backgrounds, thus creating conditions that enhance social integration by cultivating ties that bind society together, promoting peace and internal stability over time. The legacy of political authoritarianism in the Arab world has produced the exact opposite of these social trends. Instead of social cohesion, there has been social disintegration. Instead of social trust among citizens, there is widespread fear and distrust of others, of strangers who might be paid informants of the various state intelligence services that dominate society. Millions of people are employed as spies of the ruling regimes, and whose job is to spy on their fellow citizens in order to preserve the authoritarian status quo. The net result of this type of politics is the production of a culture of fear, paranoia, anxiety, and conspiracy theories that gradually open the door to social disintegration and then radicalism when a shock is inflicted on a society in the form of a war, an uprising, or when the state collapses. And this is, I think, what is so unique about the rise of ISIS. One interesting way of analyzing the problem is to ask yourself the geography question. Why has the Islamic State set up its home, its so-called state, in Iraq and Syria, and not in other parts of the Muslim world? If this is a Muslim problem, why isn't the Islamic State emerging in Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country? What is it about Iraq and Syria that is so unique? And I think the answer to that question is precisely what I've been talking about. It's in Iraq and Syria where you see the convergence of these two trends in their most toxic and corrosive manner: the legacy of political authoritarianism and the breakdown of state and the collapse that ensues from the collapse of states. If you, for example, were to rank all of the countries in the Arab League, there's about 22 countries, if you were to rank them on a spectrum of repression, Iraq and Syria should be located at the extreme end of a spectrum of repression, given the nature of the post-colonial regimes under the Ba'ath parties that were in power for many decades. The legacy that those tyrannical regimes left on their societies in terms of the human rights violations, the number of political prisoners, the torture, the surveillance, the totalitarian nature of those societies were far brutal than the other members of the Arab League. None of them democratic, none of them, regimes that you would want to sort of consider a model. All of them torture states, but there was something unique about Iraq and Syria. in terms of the level of the brutality, this has produced consequences. It has destroyed the social fabric of those societies in ways that don't have comparison with other parts of the Arab Islamic world. Let's get to the question of war and state collapse. That's another unique distinguishing quality about Iraq and Syria that explains why, in these two countries, the Islamic State has established its so-called state. Take the case of Iraq. For the last 37 years, Iraq has been experiencing some form of war that has destroyed the social fabric, the politics, the society. Start in 1980, if you know your history. 8 years of war between Iraq and Iran killed about 1 million people on both sides. About 250,000 Iraqis were killed, destroyed the economic infrastructure of that country, created a massive debt. It was a 2-year brief interim period, then you had what was called Gulf War I. Iraq invades Kuwait, an international coalition is organized to expel Iraq from Kuwait. Iraq is put under comprehensive UN sanctions that destroys civil society and destroys the basic development indicators of Iraq during the 1990s. Infant mortality skyrockets. Malnutrition skyrockets. Basic human development indicators destroy that society and ironically strengthen the regime. That brings us up to 2003, and you should know the rest of the story. The 2003 Bush-Cheney Anglo-American invasion of Iraq and the chaos and mayhem that continues until this day. That's Iraq. Neighboring Syria, it's a similar story with one critical difference. The effects of the war in Syria have been 1,000 times worse, and the collapse of the state there, in contrast to Iraq, is almost complete. By the end of the first year of the Syrian uprising in 2012, all of the leading human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the UN Independent Special Commission of Inquiry on Syria, charged the regime in Damascus with state-sanctioned war crimes and crimes against humanity. On the third anniversary of that war, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a global plea, noting that Syria now is the biggest humanitarian peace and security crisis facing the world. The moral and humanitarian catastrophe that has engulfed Syria has only gotten worse with every passing year. As the conflict entered its fifth year, two new reports have established that the year 2014 was the deadliest year of the Syrian conflict. Over 250,000 people have been killed. Close to 1 million have been wounded, a figure that reflects 6% of Syria's population. In the past 4 years, life expectancy in Syria has dropped by 27 years, and more than half of Syria's 23 million people are now either internally displaced or have they have fled the country and now are officially registered as UN refugees. The conflict in Syria has produced the world's worst refugee crisis of the 21st century. It has also produced a chemical weapons crisis. It has also produced an unreported rape crisis, a polio crisis, a hunger crisis, a torture crisis. And as a result and as a consequence of all of these crises, it has produced an ISIS crisis. It's precisely and exactly these quasi-genocidal conditions that have created a fertile soil for the rebirth and the expansion of radical Islamist militancy in this part of the Arab world. Iraq and Syria are unique and distinct for these reasons. And that's why this vacuum that has been created as a result of these two twin processes have allowed for radical Islamist groups to insert themselves and to provide a different narrative that unfortunately has attracted the attention of some people. Deeply connected to this whole question is the crisis of legitimacy of the ruling states in Iraq and Syria. In the case of Iraq, after the 2003 American invasion, the political order that was established in Iraq resulted in the rise of Shia political parties that came to power. And they came to power for one good reason. They had the demographic numbers. 60% of Iraq are Shia. Under Saddam Hussein, they were repressed. They win the elections, they come to power, and unfortunately, the leadership of these parties rule in a very majoritarian and discriminatory way with respect to the 20% of Iraqis who are Sunni. When the Sunnis in Iraq started to protest, started to complain about their alienation, their discrimination, they were ignored. When they engaged in street protests, they were persecuted. Gradually over time, the 20% of Iraqi population, not all of them, but some of them, gave up on the Iraqi state and started to look elsewhere. And one place they started to look was in the direction of these radical Islamist groups known as ISIS that started to claim that we are the representation of aggrieved Sunni populations in Iraq, telling them you can't get justice and representation in Baghdad, in the American-supported political order, come and join our radical utopian project. Now, this question of Syria and the crisis of legitimacy of the Syrian state is similar, because what you have in Syria is a minority regime ruled by one family for the last 45 years. All of the senior positions are staffed by loyalists of that particular family that come from one particular minority group, and the vast majority of Syrians are Sunnis, 70%. They don't feel that they can get representation. They staged an uprising. It was largely peaceful. And then it was crushed violently and brutally. And then ISIS emerged and inserted itself and said, look, we are the champion of Sunni grievances in this part of the world. Now, this leads to another, I think, critical, important event that I've touched upon, but I want to say a bit more because it's absolutely central to understanding the ISIS crisis, why the ISIS crisis has emerged now as the preeminent global crisis facing the world. I've written in a long essay recently that all roads lead to Damascus. And what I mean by that is that you cannot understand the rise and expansion of ISIS unless you understand the roots of the current conflict in Syria. As one senior American general recently noted, Syria is like a geopolitical Chernobyl. It's going to continue to spew radioactivity, instability, and extremist ideology over the entire region until this conflict is brought to an end. Syria is intimately linked to the ISIS crisis in several ways. If you know the history of ISIS, ISIS emerges as an al-Qaeda franchise in Iraq in 2003-2004. Over time, however, this al-Qaeda operation in Iraq is crushed and defeated, largely as a result of several factors: American troop surge, the ability of Sunni tribes in Iraq to switch sides and side with the central government in Baghdad fighting ISIS. So the story is that when you get to about the year 2010-2011, when American troops were about to be withdrawn from Iraq, ISIS, or the parent organization of ISIS, al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2010, is a shadow of its former self. Most of its senior leaders are either killed or captured. Osama bin Laden at this time is assassinated, and it seems like this organization is dead. But what happens around this time, early 2011, the Arab Spring protests and uprising, starting in Tunisia, sweeping across the Arab world, arrive in Syria in March of 2011. And as I mentioned a moment ago, people in Syria start to protest, and they begin nonviolently. The protests were overwhelmingly peaceful, non-sectarian. People were demanding dignity, democracy, social justice. And the response to these peaceful protests by the Assad regime was to unleash a merciless wave of violence, a criminal, brutal response where people were literally mowed down in the streets while the international community stood on the sidelines and watch this conflict happen. And gradually that peaceful uprising became militarized, and in its second year it started to become radicalized as this type of repression increases, approaching by the first year of this conflict to near genocidal proportions. Now ISIS inserts itself in this chaos and mayhem, starts to become it begins as a very small group. They come over from the Iraqi border into Syria, and they start to gain currency, benefiting from this unleashing of violence that is so colossal that people are so disoriented that some of them think that the ISIS narrative provides a way forward to their current plight. According to U.S. military intelligence, 2/3 of the ISIS military forces are located in eastern Syria. The de facto capital of ISIS in Raqqa is located in Syria. Most of the Western hostages that were executed were executed in Syria. In other words, the future of ISIS is deeply connected to the political future of Syria. As the veteran Middle East journalist Robin Wright has rightly observed, Syria is the strategic center of this region. What happens there will affect everyone. These two conflicts, these two events are deeply linked. Finally, President Obama has realized this, that there's no way you can organize a group of Syrians to go and fight ISIS unless you deal first with the internal problems within Syria that have to do with the rule of the House of Assad that's been in power for 45 years. Now, what we've been seeing in Syria is relevant to what's happening in the world today. The conflict in Syria is now approaching the end of its fifth year. There are lessons here that remind me of what was happening in this world about 20 years ago, when there was a conflict in Bosnia that approached and was, in fact, a genocide, and the international community stood on the sidelines for 3 years saying, we're not going to get involved. And the arguments that were advanced back then with respect to Bosnia are the exact same arguments that we've been hearing today in the U.S. foreign policy debate. You know, yes, there's massive human suffering, but there's no core U.S. strategic interest involved in these conflicts. To get involved is a risk. It doesn't affect us directly. We're not going to get involved. And the logic with respect to the conflict in Syria, right from the beginning, was that the conflict in Syria, it was argued in 2011, 2012, 2013, was that what happens in Syria can be contained. It won't affect anyone. That was the assumption that the Obama administration made, largely as a result of the legacy and the horrors of the Iraq War. But that is an assumption and a calculation that we can now see was arguably perhaps the biggest foreign policy miscalculation of the Obama administration, because the conflict in Syria, as we can see, has not stayed in Syria. The conflict in Syria now is playing out in San Bernardino, in Paris. In the first 3 weeks of this year, there was at least 7 separate attacks directed or inspired in one way or the other as a result of ISIS. And the ISIS crisis is a direct result of the inability or refusal of the international community to deal with the conflict in Syria. Had there been, I think, a more appropriate response to the conflict in Syria much earlier, we wouldn't have an ISIS crisis. Remember, in 2011, there was no ISIS in Syria. There was no Al-Qaeda in Syria. But as a direct result of what's happened, the failure of the international community and the refusal of the international community to stand up to Russia's aggressive action in Syria today, where Russia and Iran basically are writing the rules. As we speak today, the rebel-held part of Aleppo has now been fully encircled. This peace process that was taking place in Geneva has collapsed. And Russia is basically unilaterally determining the future of Syria, while the international community today is gathered in London. And they're talking about gathering funds to rebuild Syria. But of course, Syrians are dying in massive numbers. There is starvation. There are besieged cities. There were war crimes taking place. And it seems as if the world leaders gathered in London are living in a parallel universe. They're talking about raising money to save and help Syrians, while at the exact same moment, there is a massive influx of refugees fleeing the city of Aleppo, going to the Turkish border. And no one wants to stand up, and no one wants to exercise leadership. And so, as bad as Syria has been over the last 6 years, in many ways, I fear that the worst is yet to come. Now, let me turn to another aspect of the ISIS crisis that I think is really central to what's going on, and that has to do with the crushing of the Arab Spring protest. About 5 years ago today, everyone was looking at the Arab world, and everyone was optimistic. It looked like that long-standing dictators were toppling. Democratic openings were taking place. There was a lot of optimism. But as you got to the year 2013, about 2 years after the Arab Spring uprisings, the old ruling elites, armies, deep state, as they're called, started to reassert themselves, and they started to crush those uprisings. And the most dramatic, I think, case that's worth noting here is the case of Egypt. Here in the United States and around the world, the Western world, we are all outraged over what happened in Paris in November of last year. 131 people were killed. But how many people know that approximately 2 years ago, in downtown Cairo, in a couple of hours, 1,000 people were killed by the Egyptian military using American-made weapons in what Human Rights Watch called likely a crime against humanity and perhaps the worst massacre of civilians in human history. I'm talking about the Rabaa al-Adawiya massacre of August the 14th, 2013. Don't take my word for it. Look up the Human Rights Watch reports. That event embodied the crushing of the Arab Spring. That event in that summer, you know, basically put an end to the democratic process that was taking place in Egypt. The military reasserted itself. There was a massive roundup of opposition figures, particularly those moderate Islamist figures who were committed to electoral politics, who rejected nonviolence. There's 42,000 of them living and rotting in Egyptian prisons today. And now we have reports of people who have come out of that prison talking about the internal debates among prisoners. And what they're telling us should concern us greatly, because what's happening in Egyptian prisons is that Egyptian young people are being radicalized. So these are how the debates are taking place in Egyptian prisons. The ISIS prisoners, the Al-Qaeda prisoners are walking around Egyptian prisons with their chests puffed out, very confident, mocking and ridiculing all of the Muslim Brotherhood and moderate Islamist prisoners and saying, "See, we told you so. We told you not to put your faith in elections and in Western democracy and in Western human rights. Look what happened when the coup d'etat took place, when the Rabaa al-Adawiya massacre took place. Where was the West? Where were the Western leaders? Where were Western intellectuals? None of them came to your rescue. The only way to bring about change," ISIS political prisoners tell their fellow prisoners, "is to join our radical utopian revolutionary project. Peaceful political change doesn't matter. Look where the dictator of Egypt is today. He's meeting with David Cameron, Prime Minister of Great Britain. He's shaking hands with the President of France." When John Kerry, the Secretary of State of this country, was commenting on events in the summer of 2013, when these events were happening, he described the coup d'etat in Egypt as, quote, "a case of restoring democracy." And then when he met General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, the person responsible for these events, Secretary of State Kerry is quoted as saying that he was, quote, "impressed by General el-Sisi's commitment to human rights." Now, this has a toxic and radicalizing effect in Egyptian prisons when they are watching these events going around and the ISIS prisoners are mocking all of those people who committed themselves to democracy and electoral politics. And all the reports are is that no one can answer back. The ISIS narrative, the ISIS debaters win the day. And you're seeing, as we speak right now, a radicalization of Egyptian politics. Because if you're a young man or woman in Egypt today and you're interested in political change, you have two choices. Shut up and accept the neo-fascist order of General el-Sisi, or look elsewhere. And where are you going to look? What's the echo? What's getting attention? What seems to be, you know, in the offering in terms of political change? It's ISIS. And so all of this, I think, goes to prove a truism about politics everywhere, not just in the Middle East, but everywhere, that was, I think, best articulated in that famous statement by President John F. Kennedy in 1962, when he said, quite rightly, that those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. And now we have to turn to, I think, the next dimension of the ISIS crisis, which is also poorly understood and hasn't received, I think, the attention that it deserves. Where do the intellectual and specifically the religious ideas that inform ISIS come from? Can we trace these ideas to a particular part of the Islamic world? Do these ideas have an intellectual or theological genealogy? A big part of the ISIS crisis, in my view, is related to the development and the mainstreaming of a particular Sunni interpretation of Islam that is deeply sectarian, violent, an interpretation of Islam that is anti-women, anti-minority, deeply intolerant, and critically supports and legitimizes the use of violence against other people who have alternative interpretations of Islam. The roots of this particular trend are fairly recent historically. They've reached a critical mass in the Middle East in the latter half of the 20th century, and they're deeply connected to what UCLA law professor Khaled Abu Fadl has called the rise of the culture of ugliness in modern Islam. And it is this rise of a culture of ugliness that is connected to one particular country that is responsible, that is the ideological home of ISIS, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So I recall when ISIS sort of emerges on the world stage and started to execute and behead and then disseminate these beheadings on social media. There was about five or six beheadings that took place in the summer of 2014. One of my students turned to me and said, "Professor Hashemi, why is there such global outrage over the beheading of five Western prisoners when at the exact same time, during the exact same time period, in neighboring Saudi Arabia, 21 people were beheaded and the State Department didn't even issue one word of protest?" If you look at what's happening in Saudi Arabia with respect to its human rights record, specifically with respect to beheadings, we see that Amnesty International notes that by the end of 2014, 83 people were beheaded in Saudi Arabia. As we get into the year 2015, Amnesty International issues a report, executions in Saudi Arabia at a 20-year high. This continued throughout the year 2015, and if you're following your news, 2016 is inaugurated with a mass execution in Saudi Arabia, killing 47 people, including a prominent Shia dissident cleric. What I'm trying to get at here is if you actually look at the crime and punishment policies in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and you compare it with the crime and punishment policies in ISIS-controlled areas, they're almost identical. Death for blasphemy happens in both societies. Death for treason happens in both societies. Stealing, adultery, murder, all of these crimes have the exact identical crime and punishment policies in both countries. And this speaks to the point that the theological ideas and underpinnings are directly coming from Saudi Arabia, and they are informing the ISIS activists and the ISIS leadership. When ISIS set up its Islamic State, it needed textbooks to teach in their so-called education system. Where did the ISIS leaders go to get textbooks? They went to the internet, and they downloaded textbooks from the Ministry of Education from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The theological underpinnings, in other words, are exactly the same. Where ISIS and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia differ are in the political orientation, the interpretation of what's called Wahhabi Islam. This is the Saudi variant of puritanical Islam that can be located in Saudi Arabia, that ISIS has adopted. This particular interpretation of Wahhabi Islam in Saudi Arabia preaches deference to the monarch. The ISIS interpretation of Wahhabi Islam believes that existing monarchs and existing states have no legitimacy, they should all be torn down, and there should be the creation of what's called a caliphate. Now, the roots of this particular Wahhabi interpretation are important to understand because they can't be simply diminished to Saudi Arabia or the Middle East. What happens, and why Saudi Arabia is such an important part of the ISIS crisis, is that in the mid-20th century, Saudi Arabia becomes a major oil-producing country. And we see, as a result of the rise of Saudi Arabia as a major oil-producing country, the marriage of Saudi petrodollars with Wahhabi Islam. And Saudi Arabia starts to spread this particular interpretation of Islam, not only throughout the Middle East, but throughout the Muslim world, via a process of giving scholarships to students to come and study in Saudi Arabia, giving scholarships to religious teachers or imams to come and get religious training and then go back into their societies and preach this particular interpretation of Islam. A colleague of mine at Harvard conducted a study of the literature in one particular Muslim community in Birmingham, England, and found that 80% of the books that were used in this one particular community had a Saudi or Wahhabi ideological orientation. If you look at some of the recent terrorist bombings that have taken place in Paris, or even the Boston bombings, for example, there are deep and intimate ties to Saudi Wahhabi theology. I don't have time to go into it, but if someone asks me, I'll be happy to provide the details. So this this link between Saudi Wahhabi Islam, the dissemination of this interpretation of Islam around the world, masquerading as normative Islam and displacing alternative interpretations of Islam that I would argue historically have been much more popular in the Muslim world, that were more ethical, that were more humanistic, but now have no currency and no opportunity to compete with the Wahhabi version of Islam. So today, if you're a young Muslim kid in Karachi, Pakistan, or in London, England, or in Toronto, Canada, and you're interested in finding out something about your own religious heritage, connecting with your theological past, the likelihood that you will be exposed to an ultra-conservative Wahhabi interpretation is very high. The likelihood that you will be exposed to a more ethical and humanistic interpretation of Islam is very low. This is a big problem, and this is why Saudi Arabia is part of the ISIS crisis. Now, we cannot have, and we should not have, a conversation, an honest conversation about Saudi Arabia in this country unless we acknowledge the deep and intimate links between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United States government. Going back to 1945, when then-President Roosevelt met then King Ibn Saud on a U.S. aircraft carrier off the shores of Saudi Arabia, and a close relationship was struck that has stayed until this day, where Saudi Arabia and the United States are the closest of partners, the closest of allies. When you hear the phrase moderate Arab ally, Saudi Arabia is one of those moderate Arab allies. And this relationship is so deeply infused into our political culture that both Republican and Democrat and much of our intellectual class simply sort of accept it as being beyond question and beyond reproach. And the problem is so, I think, catastrophic that I was reminded of this exactly a year ago today when the longstanding king of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah, passes away, and his successor, King Salman, comes to the throne. It just so happened at this time, when the King of Saudi Arabia passes away, President Obama was in India on an official state visit. He stops his visit short, and he goes to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to pay homage to the new king. Before he left India, on his way to Saudi Arabia, CNN journalist and reporter Fareed Zakaria interviews Obama in New Delhi before he gets on the plane to go to Saudi Arabia. And he asks President Obama, when you go to Saudi Arabia, are you going to raise the question of human rights? Are you going to raise the question that was current at this time of this young Saudi blogger, a man by the name of Raif Badawi, who started to post some commentary on his Facebook website calling for a more liberal interpretation of Islam? He was picked up by the Saudi regime, and he was condemned and charged to 10 years in jail, plus 1,000 lashes to be administered, 100 lashes every Friday until you get to 1,000. Fareed Zakaria asks specifically President Obama, are you going to raise the case of Raif Badawi when you meet the Saudi leadership? And President Obama looks Fareed Zakaria straight in the eye and says, no, I will not talk about human rights. Why? Fareed Zakaria asks him, because this is President Obama's own words, I'm paraphrasing him here. Every time we raise the question of human rights with our Saudi allies, they get upset. And they don't like it. And he did go on to say that he's tried to, in a roundabout way, raise the question of human rights. But then you have all these, you know, embarrassing situations where Saudi Arabia, through a plan of sort of gerrymandering, gets appointed to the UN Human Rights Council. You know, I don't have time to go into the details, but they get appointed to the UN Human Rights Council. And the State Department issues a statement welcoming Saudi's Saudi Arabia's appointment to the UN Human Rights Council. And now we know that Saudi Arabia is a problem. Every time I talk to American audiences and I talk about the negative side of our relationship with Saudi Arabia, the negative consequences that flow from this type of relationship, everyone instinctively knows that this is a problem. And we were reminded of this on 9/11 when it was announced soon after those attacks that 15 out of the 19 hijackers came from one country, Saudi Arabia. Now, either that's a fluke, an accident, or it suggests something deeply problematic about Saudi society, where 15 middle-class, fairly educated young people think that the best way that they can spend their lives on this planet is to go and engage in that type of suicidal terrorism. There are deep problems here in Saudi Arabia. 60% of the suicide bombings committed by ISIS in October of last year and September and October of 2014 were conducted by Saudis. After the November 2015 massacre in Paris, most of the tweets supporting that massacre were coming from Saudi Arabia. There's a long list here. I can go on and on. The point here is the following. Due to its puritanical, idealized, and thoroughly mythologized view of the past, Wahhabi Islam cannot reconcile its theological orientation with the complexity and the diversity of cultures that constitute our modern world. As a result, Wahhabi Islam has added a dimension of oppressiveness and vehemence to the contemporary Muslim life that frequently borders on the morbid. Let me get to a conclusion. The crisis that we are now seeing in the Arab world today was predictable and was to be expected. In fact, 14 years ago, in a series of UN Arab Human Development reports written by leading Arab social scientists, they actually forecast and predicted the deep crisis that this region is facing, hinting at a coming political explosion. Starting in 2002, in their first report, they concluded that the Arab world is at a crossroads and that the region is hampered by three key deficits that are considered to be defining features of the Arab world. Number one, a freedom deficit. Number two, a women's empowerment deficit. And number three, a knowledge deficit. Compared with the rest of the world, this UN report noted that the Arab countries had the lowest freedom scores in the 1990s when measured by indicators such as political processes, civil liberties, political rights, free media, etc. The Arab region had the lowest value of all of the regions of the world for voice and political accountability. In their follow-up report in 2004, on the theme of freedom, good governance, and political reform, they re-emphasized this point, that if you look at the broad theme of good governance related to civil and political rights, popular participation, representative institutions, political accountability of leadership, the existence of the rule of law, the equality of treatment of citizens, the existence of an independent judiciary, all of these were found to be in short supply. And so, summarizing my speech, let me quote from one of my favorite intellectuals and writers of the Arab world, Rami Khoury from the American University of Beirut, had the following things to say about the state of the Arab world and its connection to ISIS. Quote, "In my 45 years in the Arab world, observing and writing about the conditions on the ground, the only thing that surprises me now is why such an extremist phenomenon that has caused the catastrophic collapse of existing states didn't happen earlier. At least since around the year 1970, the average Arab citizen has lived in political, economic, and social systems that have offered zero accountability, political rights, and participation. States have been characterized by steadily expanding dysfunction and corruption, economic disparities that have driven majorities of people into chronic poverty and humiliating inaction." And then Rami Khoury goes on to identify the existing authoritarian political order in the Arab world as being the key culprit here. "This existing authoritarian political order has virtually banned the developing of one's full potential in terms of intellect, creativity, public participation, culture, and identity. The Islamic State phenomenon is the latest, and perhaps not the final stop on a journey of mass Arab humiliation and dehumanization that has been primarily managed by the Arab autocratic regimes that revolve around single families or clans with immense and continuing support from foreign patrons. Foreign military attacks in Arab countries such as in Iraq have exacerbated this trend, as has Israel's aggression against the Palestinian people. But the single biggest driver of the kind of criminal Islamist extremism that we now see is this phenomenon, this predicament of several hundreds of million of individual Arab men and women who find that generation after generation that in their own societies they're unable to achieve their full humanity or reach their full potential or exercise their full powers of thought, creativity, and in many cases simply obtain the basic necessities of life for themselves and their family. There is only one antidote in the end to eliminating the Islamic State and all that it represents, and that is to stop pursuing the abusive and criminal policies that have demeaned millions of decent Arab men and women and shaped Arab countries for the past half century. Bombing Iraq and Syria will gain some time and probably must happen in combination with serious military action by local Arab and Kurdish forces. However, if the ways of the corrupt modern Arab security state is not radically reversed, the mass desperation and hysteria that the Islamic State represents will only reemerge again in more extreme forms in the years to come. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much.
Great.
I'm going to start with the easy one. And you sort of wrapped it up just a little bit at the end, but I'm going to challenge you to answer the question of the title of the speech, which is how the world should respond.
Right. Well, I think the only answer that I think does justice to the question is that there's no quick fixes here. There's no easy answers here. I think we need to be doing many things. There's not one response. The problems that we're facing today and that we're seeing today with respect to the rise of ISIS have been building for many decades. So I think we have to be operating on many different levels. My biggest concern is that the response that President Obama has organized, in his own words, is a counterterrorism strategy. And the problem with ISIS is not simply a problem of terrorism. Yes, that's one dimension of the problem, but the root causes, the social conditions that have given rise to ISIS have to be addressed. And I don't see that happening. So I think there's things that we need to be doing in the short term in terms of trying to defeat ISIS and roll it back and crush it. But there's also things that we need to be doing in terms of a long-term strategy. Now, on the short term, we can have a debate over whether President Obama's strategy is working or not. I have mixed views. I think he's doing some things good. I think there's other things that he's not doing. But I think the big gap here and the big criticism that I have is over these long-term issues that I've been talking about. There is no, I think, interest in the United States or even in the Western world to talk about these long-term fundamental problems of human and political development that have now reached such a catastrophic level in the Arab world that these societies are destroyed. Now, unless we start dealing with those underlying fundamental problems that everyone sort of recognizes, when you have a conversation with people, they'll say, of course, these things make sense. We need good governance. We need better human development. We need protection for human rights. Everyone will acknowledge that those are problems, those are goals that we have to reach. However, if you look at the policies that we're actually pursuing, they're policies that, in many ways, are undermining those long-term goals. So, for example, exactly a year ago, approximately a year ago, President Obama gave a very famous speech on countering violent extremism, where he made these arguments. You know, I have the words here, I could read it to you, but basically he said, look, what we need in this part of the world in order to win the war against violent extremism is we have to give young people hope, an option, an economic future, better governance,
If we don't do that, the terrorists are going to exploit it. We need more democracy, he said, not less. Now, here's the rub. When he gave that speech, sitting in the front row were the ambassadors of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, Morocco, Jordan, you name them. So it's in that chasm, what the president sort of has identified as goals that we have to reach, and most rational people can agree upon, but the actual existing policies that we're pursuing are, and the governments that we're allied with, are actually pursuing the antithesis of the goals that the president has outlined. And so I think in that chasm is where the problem lies. And so those are things that I think we need to be thinking about. We don't have a grand strategy, a long-term strategy for the Middle East, and we are basically pursuing policies that are putting out fires. There's a problem here, a problem there, another problem emerges. But the underlying social and political conditions of the Middle East, as a result of what I call the broken politics of the Middle East, are not being addressed. And until they are, this region is going to continue to produce and export instability.
You talked about the parallel universe, and just today, $11 billion in London is being pledged to solve this problem. Isn't that the West's, I mean, what else could we hope to do besides, I don't understand how we can even begin to conquer these issues that you're laying out other than throw money at it?
Well, I think the money is important, right? But what's so ironic about the event that you just mentioned is that there's a big meeting in London, everyone's pledging money to rebuild Syria. At the exact same time, when Russian aircraft over the last 3 days have launched 900 airstrikes against rebel positions, not going after ISIS, going after rebel positions in order to bolster the regime of Bashar al-Assad, who is at the root of the problem in Syria and embodies the larger problem of the legacy of political authoritarianism that is tearing the region apart. No one wants to deal with that issue. So we're talking about how we can get money to help Syria while Syria is being destroyed at the exact same moment by Russia, that is allegedly a co-sponsor of these peace talks and has its own nefarious agenda. Now, this raises, of course, difficult issues that are difficult for Americans to talk about because we are a war-traumatized society, and I'm speaking about Iraq and Afghanistan. No one, just to give you an example, because I've been following the story of Syria very closely, in 2013, August, when Bashar al-Assad used sarin gas on the outskirts of Damascus, killing approximately 1,400 people, according to U.S. intelligence, about 400 children. And President Obama said, my red line had been crossed. I'm going to respond. We cannot allow a country to use weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons on civilians. And it seemed like he was going to do something. It was really, if you look back, a symbolic sort of airstrike. Public opinion in this country was overwhelmingly against that action, even though the vast majority of Americans acknowledged and would admit that Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons, but the number of Americans who were willing to support a symbolic U.S. airstrike in Syria against a war criminal was probably in the 10 to 11%. Why? Because when Americans looked at Syria, they saw Iraq. And they saw, this is a slippery slope. We've been there before. We've seen this movie before. So there are, I think, deep lessons here that I think we need to learn, that when you have conflicts that rise to the level of crimes against humanity, state-sanctioned war crimes, genocide, thinking that those conflicts can simply be ignored, can simply be forgotten, and they won't contaminate our region is, I think, a miscalculation. Now, what President Obama could have done or shouldn't have done or can do today is, I think, a subject to debate. I think reasonable people can agree to disagree. I think that President Obama's calculation, ignoring Syria, hoping that it would simply sort of solve itself by itself, or allowing Russia to unilaterally intervene and write the rules of this conflict, trying to bolster Bashar al-Assad, thinking that somehow this region can be stabilized by extending the shelf life of the one individual who is overwhelmingly responsible for the atrocities and the violence, is, I think, a recipe for greater disasters to come. So nobody wants to get involved to stop the dictator. No one wants to get involved to stand up to Russia. And so we're seeing this conflict. As we speak, at this moment, tens of thousands of refugees are reported to be fleeing the northern town of Aleppo, heading to the Turkish border. And the Turkish government is saying, we've got 2 million refugees here already. There's no more left. Half of them have left and they've gone into Europe. They're destabilizing Europe. So this conflict in Syria now is so catastrophic that the tragedy is that, as bad as it's been over the last 5 years, unfortunately the worst seems yet to come.
We can have some Q&A. We took a lot of time, so we'll have about 10 minutes for Q&A, but while we're doing that, I have one last question. Everything to me is through the prism right now of the what's happening in our political system right now. Iowa Monday, New Hampshire this week, next week. Can you just give a quick snapshot of what might be and what position we would be best served by? I don't know if you want to get that political, but
no, I do want to get that political. Well, look, you know, I'm watching this debate very closely, and of course, foreign policy is a big part of it because we've had San Bernardino, and we've had, you know, Paris attacks, and we've had the war in ISIS. Watching all of these candidates who aspire to be president seems to me a choice between Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
But Trump says he can stand up to Putin.
He says he can get along with Putin very well. They can sort of strike deals. He knows how to make deals. Of course, he wants to make a deal with a person who's backing, you know, the one regime in the Middle East that's responsible for all the mayhem. So that's Donald Trump. But I think there is one candidate that has caught my attention and who I think, were he to be elected president, I think there's some hope that our politics and our foreign policy can be perhaps realigned and calibrated in a more constructive direction. And I'm talking about Bernie Sanders. Now, Bernie Sanders on foreign policy and on Syria has not said a lot. But what Bernie Sanders, I think, has identified is the one issue that is at the core of our foreign policy disorientation, but it also has implications for our domestic policy as well. And that is the problem of our own broken democratic politics. Our politics, as Bernie Sanders, I think, have rightly identified, is excessively controlled by Wall Street bankers, by billionaires, by lobbyists, who have disproportionate influence over our elected officials. And so our elected officials are responsive not to the needs of this country or the needs of the average American citizen, they're responsive to the people who are financing their campaigns. And so even when you get someone like President Obama, who in my view was perhaps the most progressive president that has ever occupied that office, he had to spend a lot of his time fundraising, a lot of his time raising money for campaigns, because you can't get elected in this country unless you can raise billions of dollars and you have rich friends. Even Hillary Clinton, I mean, in the town hall meeting that just took place a few days ago, there was a very fascinating and insightful exchange where Hillary Clinton was asked, if you claim to be a progressive, you claim to offer change, how do you explain getting almost $700 million in speaking fees from Goldman Sachs? How progressive can that be? How different are you than any other politician? That's not progressive politics. And so I think what I like about Bernie Sanders is he's identified what is corrupting our domestic politics, our democracy. We need massive and serious campaign finance reform. We have to take our democracy back. We have to make sure that our foreign policy, and this has implications for the question of ISIS. Why are we so cozy and buddy-buddy with Saudi Arabia? Well, Saudi Arabia purchases a lot of our arms. There's a lot of rich corporations that benefit from this relationship. Saudi Arabia invests a lot of the money that it gains for the selling of oil into the U.S. economy. And if you can get an American politician to talk about Saudi Arabia, and if you can corner him and ask him, why are we supporting this country, they will say, it's about jobs. If we break that relationship, there's going to be unemployment in this country. And so Americans are going to have to sort of think about these questions. But I think overall, both on the foreign policy side and on the domestic side, we need a massive transformation and rejuvenation of our political system. And by getting private money out of our political system, by having fair and equitable campaign finance reform, from preventing lobbyists and private corporations and big business from dominating our political system, I think if we can do that, if Bernie Sanders can do that, not only will we start to fix our foreign policy problems in the Middle East, gradually, perhaps over time, but also our domestic politics and the many problems that affect and are corrupting our domestic politics and that are eroding the middle class and making it almost impossible. I mean, I teach at a university where students have to pay $40,000 in tuition. I come from Canada where I went to school and most of it was government subsidized. I paid at most $6,000 and I got a great education. And that's the norm for most of the modern world. So there are deep problems here that I think we need to fix, and they're all interlinked. And so I said that if Bernie Sanders has a chance of winning, I never thought I would say this, but I will actually go door to door in Colorado and campaign for him.
We'll take some questions from the audience.
I wanted to ask about the Saudis, and specifically if the Saudis moved right in a conservative direction in the 50s as a response to criticism about the lavishes of the royals, and kind of appeased their critiques through setting up the religious police and endorsing the kind of ultra-conservative Wahhabism that we see now. And it succeeded in insulating themselves against that critique and making them more powerful, allied with the West. So as a result of that, they're pretty stable for themselves, right? They're armed to the teeth. So are they now prepared to lead a coalition of the other Sunni petro oligarchies in the region against the very ideology that they seeded decades ago? And if they are prepared to do that, what's the likelihood of that happening? Or what would have to be the kind of politics on the Arabian Peninsula that would lead towards those countries using their considerable U.S.-backed militaries against ISIS?
Well, what you've just suggested is actually playing itself out in real time. And I'm talking about Yemen. Saudi Arabia is pursuing a war in Yemen using its military. The United States is not directly involved. It's sort of in the backgrounds involved. And if you know anything about Yemen, just look it up. It's a catastrophe. There's massive human suffering. They're bogged down, locked in the war. Saudi Arabia does not have an effective organized fighting force. They've got a lot of weapons that we've sold them. They're one of the biggest producers of arms. But they're not an organized fighting force that can go and fight hand-to-hand combat with ideologically zealous followers represented in ISIS. When Saddam Hussein occupied Kuwait, it's the United States that came in and bailed and protected Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia talks a lot. Just today they're talking about we're going to send troops into Syria. But Saudi Arabia and Saudi society, it's a spoiled society. It's got a lot of money. They don't have an effective fighting force. They haven't really been tested. Much of the war in Yemen is like aerial bombardment, you know, hitting mostly civilians and innocent people. I don't think there's any hope that Saudi Arabia can organize a responsible, cohesive military effort. And even if it could, we have to be very wary, because what's going to be the consequence the day after, given the ideological underpinnings and the theological orientation? Are we going to see replicas and the exporting and the implementation of Saudi Wahhabi practices in these areas that they conquer? Is that a step forward? So I think putting hope in Saudi Arabia as being a fighting force or being able to sort of get ourselves out of this mess is a dead end. There's no hope there.
Anybody else?
In European history, we have the example of Protestants and Catholics having a very long, protracted religious warfare. Eventually, it burned itself out and worked itself to somewhat of a resolution, and for the most part, it's pretty dormant. Mm-hmm. Do you see anything like that happening with the Shia and the Sunnis?
Well, that historical parallel, I think, has to be taken to its logical conclusion. Yes, there was conflict between Protestants and Catholics. Much of that conflict was over theological ideas. Much of that conflict, at least in terms of the Western world, the United States and in England, was actually an intra-Protestant conflict. You know, Catholics, you know, I teach political theory and we read John Locke's Letter on Toleration. A lot of people don't know this, but if you read John Locke's Letter on Toleration, it was largely toleration for recognized Protestant sects. Catholics weren't to be tolerated. They were just couldn't be trusted because they were loyal to the Pope. They couldn't be good English citizens. And atheists couldn't be trusted as well. So that was, you know, 1685. But a lot of that conflict was driven largely by these theological sort of battles where people simply would start a war if they saw someone else practicing a different form of Christianity. What you're seeing in the Middle East today is not a battle over questions of theology, despite what many people think. What you're seeing today is really fundamentally a political crisis and authoritarian ruling elites mobilizing and manipulating sectarian identities as a way of perpetuating their own power in the region. So just ask yourself, for example, have Sunnis and Shias always been fighting in the Middle East? If you know the history, you'll know it starts in a particular year, 1979. Prior to that, Sunnis and Shias got along very well. There is no record of conflict, at least in the modern period. What happens in 1979? There's a revolution in Iran, and it's a radical Islamist revolution, and it's trying to export it across the region. And it's a pro-American monarchy that's toppled in Iran, and the Saudis freak out because they think that mobilized and politicized Islam coming out of Iran is going to affect them. So what do? They invest heavily in the development and the cultivation and the production of an anti-Shia narrative to tell the rest of the Sunnis in their own society, don't follow that model. It has nothing to do with authentic Islam. It's a Shia bastardization, Persian, Safavid sort of, you know, interpretation of Islam that has nothing to do with being a Muslim. If you're a good Sunni Muslim, you're loyal to this regime. The conflict begins then, and it has ups and downs over the last 37 years. So the first 10 years, the 1980s, a lot of tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and a heightened conflict between Sunnis and Shias. The 1990s, it ends. What happens in the 1990s? The Iran-Iraq war is over. Iran and Saudi Arabia patch up their relationship. There's a warming of relation. 2003, another turning point. Saddam Hussein is toppled. Shia political parties come to power. Saudis are freaking out. Iran's influence is being extended. They whip up anti. So fundamentally, what's happening, I think the analogy has to be properly compared. Fundamentally, what happened in the 16th century and what's happening now are very different. There's a theological dispute there and a political dispute here. But the difference is that over time, Protestants and Catholics came to reach a modus vivendi and got to recognize and gradually to tolerate each other because of one important development: the gradual but sustained spreading and expansion of democracy, where people gradually were included in expanding spheres of inclusivity. In this country, the United States, it was largely a Protestant country. Catholics in the 19th century weren't viewed as, but that changed. In the Middle East today, unless there is an expansion and a transformation of the politics there in the direction of democracy, you're not going to see a reduction in these tensions because authoritarian ruling elites are going to continue to mobilize and politicize sectarian identities as a way of perpetuating their own power. So that question of authoritarianism and democracy is central to this comparison that you've made between, you know, Catholics and Protestants and then the comparative case of Sunnis and Shias.
One final question.
To segue from that to the immigrant crisis in Europe now, where we're beginning to see a social disruption, perceived social disruption, by this huge influx of immigrants. And this is now beginning to spew off a radical right response. Just yesterday in Sweden, we saw on television this profound violence that's being inflicted on immigrants. What do you see happening? How do you see this playing out? And what is the solution?
Well, fundamentally, you know, I looked at the figures just recently. About 1 million refugees / migrants went into Europe in 2015. About 1 million. Half of them, 50%, were from Syria. The other 25% were from Afghanistan. Societies that collapse, societies that have wars, societies where there's no hope, there's no reconstruction, produce refugees in chaos. That's going to continue to happen the more that the conflict in Syria continues, the more that Afghanistan is destabilized. These people have to go somewhere. And so the only place they can go where they have a sense there could be some safe haven is Europe. To Angela Merkel's credit, she took a huge risk going up against these right-wing parties and saying, look, based on our own history of suffering in World War II, we're going to let in these refugees. It was a controversial decision that probably will force her to pay a price at the next election. But she did it, I think, fundamentally out of a moral commitment, that we have a moral obligation. I was in Canada over the holidays. Almost brought me to tears when I turned on the television set and I saw the Prime Minister of Canada going to the airport, welcoming fleeing refugees, saying, you have a safe haven here. The entire conversation in Canada when I was there over the Christmas holidays was about how we can welcome more Syrian refugees. We haven't met our quota. CBC Radio was talking about how do you see yourself in the stories of these Syrian refugees. And everyone in Canada is an immigrant, and someone was talking about their parents in World War II, someone was a Vietnamese immigrant. And Canada again, took a risk, but showed, I think, its best face forward, saying that we will, to the extent that we can, welcome these refugees. Now, of course, there's sentiment in Canada as well, as there is in Europe and as there is in this country, that's pushing back, saying, look, we don't like these people. We don't want them. We can't trust them. Thankfully, the Prime Minister of Canada, I think, has taken the higher moral road. So what do you do about this is that we are living in a globalized world. To think that you can simply shut off the borders and say, look, those barrel bombs that are flying, those chemical weapons that are dropping, that massive human suffering, we're not going to let you in. You have to stay where you are, or you have to go and join ISIS, or you simply have to die. I think that is a position that many people are unwilling to accept, and so it's going to generate debates in our own Western societies. It's going to lead to the rise of populist politicians, as we're seeing in this country, Donald Trump, thinking that he can campaign and get elected by whipping up hysteria against Syrians and Muslims. That has a resonance, unfortunately, in countries that are suffering economically, where people are scared of terrorism, and he's blanketly condemning, you know, every single Syrian, ignoring the fact that in this country since 2001, we've accepted about 750,000 refugees, and the vast majority of them have integrated themselves and have been good citizens. The number of those refugees that we let into this country since 2001, about 750,000, overwhelmingly they have followed the law, upheld the law. And so this blanket sort of fear-mongering that we're seeing is something that we've seen in the past. You know, this is not new. Hitler used that fear to get elected. Other countries have whipped up this fear. I think this is just part of the growing pains that democratic societies have to face. There's moments in time when democratic societies are tested. Now, sometimes countries pass the test. Canada, I think, you know, is doing a great job. I think it's leading the way. I was very touched to see, Syrian refugees all discovering where Canada is and who this new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, is, and why is he coming to the airport and welcoming Syrian refugees. Now, that doesn't mean that we simply have to, that we shouldn't have proper screening, we shouldn't have background checks, we shouldn't sort of prevent, troublemakers and potential terrorists from coming into this country. We absolutely should. But it also means that we can still, I think, show our better humanity by reaching out. But fundamentally, I think the lesson here is that to think that we can live safe and secure in our comfortable liberal democracy while other parts of the world are being destroyed and devastated, and thinking that that devastation will not affect us in a globalized world, is a miscalculation. We do have a global moral responsibility to try, to the extent that we can, to address human suffering. And I think the moral burden on Americans is far greater than any other country in the world for one simple reason. For better or for worse, we are still the most powerful and influential country in the international system. We are. We're not as powerful as we once were, but compared to all the other countries, we are the most powerful and influential country. If the United States decides to organize and mobilize the international community, things can get done. If the United States decides not to do anything, things don't get done. And I think Syria is a great test case for this. We rebuilt Germany, we rebuilt Japan, we saved the Bosnian people 3 years too late, but still we intervened. People aren't dying in Bosnia today because of the Clinton administration's intervention. There are lessons there to learn. And so I think the moral burden, if you are a moral person, if you have a sense of ethics, is we have to have, I think, a much more healthy and robust debate about how our foreign policy can be oriented in more positive ways, more constructive ways, more ethical ways to address these types of crises. Because if the United States doesn't get involved, then thinking that those conflicts are not going to affect us in one way or the other is a colossal miscalculation. And I think that's fundamentally, in my view, President Obama's biggest foreign policy calculation that I predict will haunt him after he leaves office, thinking that Syria doesn't matter, thinking that Syria can be ignored. Well, obviously today, Syria does matter. It's directly related to the ISIS crisis, and the end of that story hasn't been written yet.
You've given a great bit of a charge to this group of kids who are here today, because it's all in your hands now, kids. Thank you so much, Dr. Hashemi.